Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of July. Howard Fineman is our guest the first hour of our program today, the very smart, well-connected, and personable Howard Fineman. He is Newsweek's senior Washington correspondent and columnist, senior editor and deputy Washington bureau chief, author of Living Politics, a column that began on MSNBC.com and Newsweek.com and now appears in the print magazine. Howard is an award-winning reporter and writer and analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. He appears regularly on Countdown with Keith Olbermann, Hardball with Chris Matthews, The Rachel Maddow Show, and today he's written so many Newsweek cover stories, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Republic. His 2008 national best-selling book, The 13 American Arguments, was released in paperback by Random House in the spring of 2009. He's a native of Pittsburgh. And we'll welcome phone calls for Howard Fineman. Our phone number, we have so much to talk about this hour. We'll look at unemployment. We'll talk about guns. We'll look at whether or not there are any bright lights in Afghanistan. The vice president was in Iraq for the 4th of July weekend. What's going on in that country? What about this gun decision by the Supreme Court? We'll talk about how Chicago is responding and what might be next in terms of the Supreme Court handing down more gun legislation. And, well, we have a lot more to talk about as well, as we always do. Did I give you the number 800-486? I can't remember. 8655. The email address, if you would like to talk to us via email, is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Howard Fineman, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to do it.
Thank yeah, you great to have
elaborate
you.
Elaborate introduction.
It was elaborate, wasn't it? But you know what? You're worth it.
Thank you. Being a native of Pittsburgh is probably the most important thing.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that in. That's good. It's a good place to be from. It gives you a solid, kind of a Midwestern thing, which is good. So I got to start with the heat, I guess, just because it was the lead story on NPR. Is it really hot?
It is really hot, and I think it could be over 100 again today.
Ooh.
In D.C. and up and down the East Coast. And it's a big national story because once again reminds us how thin we stretch the grid,
right.
The electric capacity, because there could be some brownouts in places.
I know. I think about that. I worry about that when I hear those stories. And you think about people who don't have air conditioning, and we all think everybody has it, but they don't.
Well, there's also a famous air conditioning theory of the growth of the federal government that was first proposed by the late, great New York Times columnist Russell Baker. He said if it weren't for air conditioning, the federal government would be a third of the size that it is, because it's only air conditioning that allows D.C. to be habitable. So,
huh. And it's probably why the North has progressed over the South, right? Don't you think?
Well, you got to slow down. You got to slow down in the South when the weather gets like that, for sure. We are below the Mason-Dixon line here.
Yeah, you really slow down. So how does a fellow like you celebrate the 4th of July?
We put a flag out on the porch, which we otherwise didn't sit on very much because it was so hot. In this case, we didn't really go anywhere. Our kids were with us. We watched a lot of fireworks. If there's a spot where you can go not far from where we live in D.C. that has a beautiful view of the whole river basin, really, it's the highest point in the district. It's where the National Cathedral is.
Mm.
And you can go up there and sit out and watch the fireworks on the mall below, which is what we did.
Oh, nice. I make everybody read the Declaration of Independence. We read it twice, actually. It's a real stirring document, isn't it? It's amazing what those Band of Brothers could do, and the fact that they won still astounds me.
Well, of course, David McCullough's book, 1776, gives a dramatic rendering of that, and it is a stirring document, and it's one that influenced not only the founding of this country, but the rest of the world. It's a document that every nation, to one degree or another, almost every nation, feels it needs to at least acknowledge, if not pay homage to. So it really is remarkable. When I wrote that book that you mentioned, The 13 American Arguments, I spent a lot of time going back to the founders and looking at how the Declaration and the Constitution helped shape who we are. And Lincoln focused a lot more on the Declaration than he did in a way, on the Constitution, for the obvious reason that the Constitution turned out to be deeply flawed over the issue of race and slavery. So Lincoln took his inspiration more from the Declaration in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with the issue of race and slavery. You wrote a piece, Roberts versus Marshall, at the Kagan hearings, and talk about the fact that Marshall is revered for his role as the lead lawyer, of course, in Brown versus the Board of Education. So it became difficult to attack Kagan versus Marshall, and he, of course, interpreting the Constitution as this document that is moving. It's a living Constitution theory. Can we talk a little bit about the issue of race in those confirmation hearings, and if indeed it's a way for the party that's not in power to fuel some racial animosity, perhaps, as the midterms approach?
Well, what I wrote about on that first day of the confirmation hearing for Elena Kagan was the fact that the Republicans, in their opposition to what they refer to as activist judging, managed to maneuver themselves into a position where they were arguing that that the legacy of Thurgood Marshall is one that should be rejected. And, you know, that's a startling proposition, but one they were sort of willing to argue. I don't think they were not intentionally saying that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided. I don't think, as a matter of fact, right. I even asked John Cornyn, Senator Cornyn of Texas, the Republican from Texas, if he thought that was wrongly decided, and he said no. But they went on to say that Marshall's brand of viewing the Constitution was one that they opposed. And there are two problems with that. One is that everybody understands that the Constitution as written glossed over, buried, and otherwise ignored the question of slavery and race in the country. Mm-hmm. And it had to be fixed. We fought, I called my book The 13 American Arguments. We fought the deadliest, bloodiest argument any nation's ever had with itself over that, to begin the process that then took 100 more years to make it right. The other problem the Republicans have is that they keep decrying activism, but the Roberts Court is one of the most activist courts that we've seen in the last century. So their arguments kind of were undercut. Are they trying to sow racial animosity? I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't really think so. It's just that they come from such another world from the one that most Democrats and indeed most of the mainstream of the country inhabits on this question that they ended up looking dangerously antique, let's say.
What in the world was the deal with a question, what do you do on Christmas?
Yeah, I spoke with Lindsey Graham about that. He's the guy who asked Elena Kagan, where were you on Christmas? He says he was trying to bring it down to the reality that we all remember from 9/11, you know, where were you on 9/11, to bring us up short and say that the terrorism and the threat of terrorism is part of the living reality of America. But it sure looked like he was trying to underscore the fact that she was Jewish.
Right.
I mean, I don't think there's much doubt about the way it looked. And I thought Kagan's response was
great.
Was hilarious.
Yes.
And quick-witted in the New York style. So it ended up becoming, you know, I was thinking of writing something about it, but in the end I decided that it was a little too quirky. In the end, I don't think it means a whole lot down the road.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with quirkiness. You can get a lot of columns out of quirkiness, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. The vice president in Iraq, what is the situation in that country? They're having a hard time forming a government almost 4 months after the elections. Is it a better place than when we invaded?
Is it a better place than when we invaded? Well, I think it's hard to argue that it isn't a better place. Because aside from the question of whether we should have gone there or not, in terms of its being related to the war against Al-Qaeda and the war on, you know, the so-called war on terror, that's a somewhat separate question from the fact that an Iraq without Saddam Hussein is a better place. There's no question about it. But the question is, at what cost? Does it set a precedent in terms of nation building that we don't want? Does it get us inextricably involved in a region that we can't afford to be in forever? Was it worth the $1 trillion that we've spent so far? And do we leave behind a society, or have we helped create a society or renew a society that can govern itself? And that's the question. The great irony of Joe Biden going there and urging everybody to form the government is that you may recall from the 2008 campaign, Joe Biden's idea was basically to break Iraq into three pieces.
Yes, right.
Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. And now, ironically, 2 years later, he's back there arguing, no, you can't divide the country into Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. You have to all get together. So either he's changed his mind about 2,000-3,000 years of Iraqi history and the divisions in Islam, or he's getting with a program he doesn't necessarily believe in.
Hmm. And what about Afghanistan, Howard? What a quagmire it is. It's hard to imagine how we're going to achieve something good there and what it would take for us to leave that country. It's a mess.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I think that there was widespread support, you may recall, for George Bush's decision to take out the Taliban. Because the Taliban had harbored al-Qaeda, provided training grounds for al-Qaeda. It was the place, in essence, where the attack on America, from which the attack on America was launched in 9/11. There was widespread support for that. But the problem is that Afghanistan is fundamentally ungovernable. It's a transfer point on the fault line of history and geography that nobody but tribes have been able to settle and control on a local basis for thousands of years. And the Russians famously failed there. The British famously failed there. We're going to fail there in the sense that we're not going to turn Afghanistan into a modern, traditionally governable country. And again, we've spent another $1 trillion there. And I think Republicans, it's very interesting to watch the Republicans now, Kathleen, because the Republicans are trying to decide whether they want to support the continued war in Afghanistan or whether they want to call it, quote, Obama's war, try to make it Obama's war and turn the other way. I mean, Michael Steele, the chairman of the Republican Party, has gotten a lot of criticism for what he said.
Right.
But Michael Steele's blurting out something that a lot of Republicans are toying with as a political strategy. And that's going to be very interesting to watch.
That's interesting. Yeah. So it's been said, and it was said a while ago, that this could be the president's undoing, this particular war. He's got a lot on his plate, but is this the thing that could be his undoing, that the anger in terms of American reaction to our plan there, the loss of American lives, et cetera, and no real progress?
Well, right now, Barack, you know, if I heard this following story once, I heard it 10 times from either David Axelrod or Rahm Emanuel or somebody else inside the White House. Somebody comes into the president and says, last year when things are really starting to really crush in, saying, Mr. President, it's too bad that we have to begin every day, you know, with two wars, that you came into office with two, you know, inheriting two wars and a great recession. To which he supposedly replied, well, if it weren't for the two wars and the Great Recession, we wouldn't even be here. Barack Obama has came into office facing some enormous, enormous problems, and he hasn't solved them. Has he tried? Yeah. Is it his fault that he hasn't? I don't know. But the impression that we're getting right now is of a guy who's worked pretty darn hard but doesn't have a lot to show for it. Either in terms of the economy or in terms of the two wars that we were discussing. And that's a bad place for a president to be in because we've inflated the presidency to a level where, you know, the president's supposed to be Superman, and if he's not Superman, then he's Jimmy Carter, to excuse the phrase.
Yeah.
And that's the risk that he's running right now.
And is that because things are so terribly gridlocked?
I think that's partly so, yes. In a way, it's a very good point. The fact that Congress is so divided, that the political process in D.C. is so gridlocked, it sort of amplifies both the power and the need of the presidency, while at the same time making it hard for the president to do anything. So Barack Obama had to put all his chips, everything that he gained in the election, he had to put it all out there for the health care bill, and he basically used it up. You know, he used up his chits for health care. And it took a Herculean effort for him to get it. Now, it's a sweeping piece of legislation, no doubt. But to watch that process so partisan, so political, so divided, is to really show you the paradox of the presidency right now. We place all our hopes in it, but we don't make it possible to do anything.
And then we've got this oil spill. Oh my gosh, it just breaks your heart day after day. It's in every Gulf Coast state. And the Times had an interesting piece, I'm sure you saw yesterday. This kind of stuff makes people mad if they know about it. Maybe they don't. This Deepwater Horizon drilling platform was flying the flag of the Marshall Islands. Registering there allowed the rig's owner to significantly reduce its American taxes.
Well, yeah, we subsidized the oil industry to a fare thee well for a whole host of reasons. Our society still runs on petroleum, and it's both a national security issue and an economic one. And the trick in the oil business is to get in between there and make money both from the government and from the oil. That's been true forever, and it's no less true in this case. To me, a far more infuriating story was one in the Washington Post this morning about how in its application to drill there and to produce well from Deepwater Horizon, British Petroleum blithely asserted that they could skim, I think, 50,000 barrels of oil a day if necessary, if there were a spill. 50,000 barrels a day. 491,000 barrels a day. In fact, they have only been able to skim so far 67,000 barrels in the entire, 3 months of this thing. So the process of permitting these wells and overseeing them, which is, a process that goes back into the Bush administration and frankly continued to the first year of the Obama administration, was a complete joke, a complete and utter joke. And now the people in the Gulf are suffering the consequences.
Howard Fineman, our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls and take them momentarily. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Howard is senior Washington correspondent for Newsweek, author of the 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. And, of course, he is a frequent commentator on NBC, on the Today Show, and on MSNBC, Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews programs. A couple lines are open. I can guarantee you they won't be for long, so feel free to call us or email us, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls and emails now for Howard Fineman. Let's start with John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hey. In the Bush administration, one of the things that President Bush was able to push through, and he probably didn't spend too much capital on it because it was a tax cut, is they did massive tax cuts that expire in 2009. And I think that's the first time we ever did tax cuts when we had two wars going on. But my question is specifically, if nothing is done, that tax cut will expire at the end of 2009. And I was wondering, quantity-wise, how much will the expiration of that tax cut, revenue-wise, reduce the deficit?
That's a good question. I don't know the specific numbers, but I know that the Obama administration is going to seek to renew some but not all of those tax cuts. The way it's going to work is that the tax cuts at the top end of the income level will be allowed to expire, but a lot of the others will continue because in talking to White House economic advisors, as I have, they are very worried about the economy, and they buy up to a certain point the idea that tax cuts are stimulative and good for the economy. So they're not really supply siders in the Reagan way, but they accept some of that theory. So you're going to as they look to an economy that is only slowly recovering, I think they're going to allow some of those tax cuts. They're going to want some of those tax cuts to be renewed.
We're a little top heavy to begin with. I'm curious if they did allow some of them to continue, percentage-wise of the revenue that was being lost, it's I would think it's insignificant, but I'd like to understand better what percentage of the revenues. My guess is what Obama is talking about allowing to go through is probably a small percentage of those, because I seem to remember that it was the upper tax brackets that were the majority of the tax revenue being lost.
Yeah, that's right. And it will help some on the deficit side, but only some. I mean, right now, they're two things. First of all, they think that the top rate can go higher. In other words, the top rates for the top income earners have been much, much higher than they are now, and they were periods of strong economic growth in the country. So on the one hand, they're saying, look, it's okay, and historically it's fine to tax the wealthiest at a higher rate than we're doing now, and they will do that. But on the other hand, they're worried about an economy that's only slowly recovering, and they don't want, if there's any way they can avoid it, to raise taxes on the middle class. They'll get some additional revenue out of that. I don't know the number. It's certainly not going to solve the deficit problem in and of itself. But we are between a rock and a hard place here. The administration knows it. It has to keep trying to stimulate the economy in various ways, with spending programs, with tax cuts. On the other hand, at some point, our mounting annual deficit and our national debt is going to make people wonder about the solvency of the United States. We're not there yet. As a matter of fact, Treasury bonds have been a great investment over the last year, counterintuitively for many people, but they have. The ironic result so far of the concern about the global economy and the American economy has been to make people buy more Treasury bonds. But at some point, that's not going to be true.
Let's look at this job picture for a while. The figures that came out Friday were only 83,000 private sector jobs created. There is not an extension of unemployment benefits. I don't know what all those people are going to do. There are so many people, as you know, Howard, looking for jobs now, and there aren't that many jobs available. It's not a matter of, well, go find something that doesn't pay as much. There are lots of those jobs, and you do hear that kind of rhetoric. What does this president need to do? It seems to me as though it's a crucial thing to put people to work.
Well, yes, and studies have shown, and these are not partisan ideological studies, that the fastest way to protect the economy, or to keep using the word stimulate, maybe there's a better word, but to put a floor under the economy, is with things like unemployment insurance, because you put money in people's pockets, you keep them part of the economy, and you offer some measure of sustenance and hope to people as they look for work. It's also true that we have extended unemployment benefits now longer. I think it's up to 90 weeks or something like that, which is much, much longer than has ever been the case before. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's necessary, but it's a controversial thing. And now the Republicans are saying we're not going to extend unemployment benefits even beyond that unless you pay for it with budget cuts elsewhere. To which the administration answers, but the whole point here is to put more money into the economy, not to take it out of the economy. And that's the argument that they're having in Washington and why the unemployment benefits have not been extended. I think it's a loser for the Republicans, because I think most people are in favor of this.
Mm-hmm. And are they having a serious discussion about military budget cuts?
Very good question. I think the Pentagon budget proposed for this coming year is $700 billion for 1 year. As I said, we have spent probably close to $2 trillion on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We're going to keep voting more money for those two projects. President is asking for money for those two projects. So even if we cut, let's say we cut the Pentagon budget 10%, which would be a colossal thing to do in Washington terms, we cut $70 billion out of it. That's not a half or a third of what we're going to spend in Iraq and Afghanistan over the next year. So those are the numbers. And I don't detect
a massive effort to cut the defense budget. Washington runs on the defense budget, which is part of the problem.
Hmm. Rob in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. Howard, thanks for being on the air. I got a couple of quick questions. They're all related to foreign policy, but I look at this administration, and my conclusion is that his foreign policy efforts have been a complete debacle, and I look at that from the standpoint of what's happened with Iran. Iran doesn't take the U.S. seriously at all. The sanctions that have been discussed in relation to Iran have been questionably mildly effective, if that. The situation with North Korea, and now we've got the situation with Mexico where we have these illegals coming in, and it's almost like he is the sympathy that he seems to project toward these countries almost undermines our standing. And the biggest one that I think is of massive concern in my mind is he has, it seems to me, that he has gradually undercut our relationship with Israel. And I just heard I wish I could remember the name of the professor, but I heard a professor from, I think he was from Princeton. I think he was a Jewish professor. And he actually made a statement that was quite shocking to me, and if I remember it correctly. And it was that basically that this president would seems to be of such a mind that if Israel were destroyed, he would be perfectly fine with it. In other words, wipe out, as long as the blood wasn't on his hands.
Oh, I find that hard to believe. But Howard, your comment.
Well, let's start generally and then get to the specifics. I mean, I guess we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. A lot of people around the world intensely dislike George W. Bush and his policies. He's probably the least popular American president in modern times on a global basis. Did that help or hurt us? Did he make the right decisions in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere around the world? You know, history will tell us. On the other hand, Barack Obama is probably the most popular American president around the world since Jack Kennedy, I would say. What has that gotten us? Not necessarily so much, necessarily. I don't know. We'll see. I think we waste too much time worrying about that question, and we should focus more on the decision-making. I agree with the caller about Iran, but it's not just America's fault. The Europeans don't take the issue seriously either. They're famously adept at putting their head in the sand, and they're doing it with respect to Iran. North Korea, I don't know how you handle that. Mexico is a problem. It's a huge problem, and securing our borders is something I think that most Americans of any stripe agree with, and I don't think the president has been tough enough on that topic, and he hasn't separated out the strands of securing the border from helping people who are here illegally, undocumented people, get into the stream of American life in a legal fashion. As far as Israel is concerned, I don't think there's any doubt about the president's commitment there. He's a younger generation. He didn't grow up with the stories of the Exodus and the Holocaust and the founding of the modern Jewish state and all that kind of thing. He doesn't go back in time to that, but neither do most Americans at this point. And it's a complicated issue. And with everything else going on in that region, it's difficult to look at it in isolation. I think the president wants Muslim and Arab allies to help us in the region, and we need those Muslim and Arab allies as much as we are committed to Israel. So he's walking a fine line here, and I think overall has done a pretty good job on it. I mean, the Israelis have brought some of the problems on themselves, and I'm not talking about Gaza in particular because they've got a difficult problem in Gaza with Hamas and so forth, people wanting to destroy Israel living in Gaza and so forth. But the way they handled the Turkish-flagged ship sailing to Gaza was a disaster that I think even most Israelis would acknowledge at this point.
Hmm. I want to ask you about presidents just generally here for a moment. Howard, I know you've interviewed most of them. Tell me who you think has the keenest mind, who was the most or is the most charismatic, And who had the best relationship with the press?
Well, Bill Clinton on numbers 1 and 2.
Really?
Bill Clinton has, with a friend of mine in Mississippi says, that boy's got a 10-pound brain. That's Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. He's once said that about Clinton. He said, that boy's got a 10-pound brain. And Bill Clinton's got a 10-pound brain. He's brilliant. He's
really
not only intellectually, but tactically and you know, politically. He's got it all, which is what made his presidency in certain respects such a shame, literally and figuratively. In terms of charisma, I would say Clinton again. Nobody lights up a room like Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is an incandescent bulb. Barack Obama is more of a fluorescent bulb. There's light but no heat from Obama. With Clinton, you got both the light and the heat. And what was the third one?
Press, relations with the press.
Well, there I think things are changing. Obama was a glorified figure in the press during his campaign.
Yes, he was.
As much for what he represented as who he, as for who he was in reality. Now things have cooled some, and I would predict that over the next year or two they're going to get pretty nasty. The funny thing about Bill Clinton is he was vilified in the press, and you know there was the vast right-wing conspiracy that Hillary talked about and that James Carville talked about. But on an individual basis, Bill Clinton has had some great relationships with reporters. I've had a mixed history with him over the years. But just in terms of sitting and talking with somebody, there's nobody more fun or more enlightening or more thought-provoking than Bill Clinton. He's just, I'm going on and on here, just because for people like me, Clinton is catnip.
I'm glad I asked you the question. I didn't expect that answer. The thing that has happened, and I remember when you were in Springfield during the announcement by Barack Obama, you know, it is an amazing time we're living in, isn't it? I'm from Illinois, and I love Springfield, and I love Abraham Lincoln. And
right.
to witness that moment, it was hard not to cry. It was something.
It was. And for anybody with any historical perspective, which is most people in America, that moment resonated like no other. And I start the I talk about that in the book that I wrote, and I do an afterword on the Obama presidency. But the first chapter of my book is about the never-ending argument we have over who is a person. And, of course, the Constitution left out black people as persons, essentially. And then to see Barack Obama launching his presidential campaign on a sunny, a frigid but sunny morning in Springfield with the sun illuminating the old gold sandstone of the old state capitol in Springfield was a great moment in history, as was his inauguration. I mean, I was maybe 100 feet from him below the podium on his inauguration day, but what was so inspiring was not looking at him, but to turn around and look out across the mall and see 1.5 million people there, most of them waving little American flags, at a moment of great peace and serenity in the country. Those two moments are ones that make my job worth doing, for sure.
I'm sure. Thanks, Rob, for your call. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Hi, Camille.
Hi. I really appreciate the chance to try to understand something here. If we could suppose for a minute that Obama went off to just seek his own counsel and came back, and with regard to the wars in the Middle East and the oil spill, let's take a big foreign issue and a big domestic issue, he determined that for the sake of all of our futures, we needed to do this and this and this. What is standing in the way, what would be standing in the way of him just making a decree, an executive decision, whatever you would call it, where he just says, okay, we're going to have to let go of this thing that we want. We're going to have to let go of that thing that we want, and this is what we need to do. Let's do it.
Well, with regard to foreign policy, there are all kinds of treaties and military alliances and so forth, whether it's with Europe and the Middle East and so forth, that would probably require the Senate to weigh in on. The president has tremendous power and latitude in foreign policy, but it's not unlimited, either in terms of alliances and treaties with countries or in terms of war-making powers, although I must say the notion that the Congress gets to vote up or down on war-making has been greatly diluted in recent decades. In terms of domestic policy, in terms of, say, the oil spill, I think there's more that he could have done on an executive basis. I think one of the valid criticisms of him on this is that he didn't, in his role as commander-in-chief, figure out other things to do with the military or issue executive orders or, you know, have more of a sense of urgency in using the executive branch of government. So, you know, those are shorthand, but I thought you were going to ask a different question, which is, what does Barack Obama really believe?
There's a good question.
Deep down in his heart and soul. And I think in terms of foreign policy, Barack Obama believes that peace is possible. I think he believes in the idea of a world where understanding, where mutual understanding across cultures can achieve peace. I think that's the story of his life. I mean, he was plopped down in various different cultures, had to learn how to survive in Indonesia, had to learn how to survive in Los Angeles, had to learn how to survive in Honolulu, learn how to survive at Harvard and Columbia and South, before he ever got to the South Side of Chicago. So his personal story is one of cultural accommodation. And I think that's his vision of the world. In terms of domestic policy, I think he believes in the federal government. I think he believes in the power of government to make things right. And that's who Barack Obama is, in my view.
Well, that's interesting. So those issues that define other presidencies, that which he really holds near and dear and he'll fight to the death for, you have a hard time finding those in him?
No, not at all. No, I don't think so. No, I think he has great faith in America. I think he's very patriotic. I think he understands that, as he has said repeatedly, that only in America would his story be possible.
Right.
Only in America. And I think that makes him deeply patriotic and understands the great virtue of this country, which is that you can make of yourself what you want if you try hard enough, that's not a myth, that he is living proof that that's possible, the great democratic ideal with a small d. And I think he would fight for that.
Yeah.
I think he would definitely fight physically for it if he had to. I don't think he knows much about markets, frankly.
Mm.
He's never in the private sector, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he knew much about the military. Neither did Bill Clinton. And neither, in fact, did George W. Bush. Don't forget, you know, he wasn't always showing up for his you know, guard duties in protecting the airspace over Houston.
Right, exactly. But when you were saying that, I'm thinking of progressives, particularly Howard, who have criticized this president's because they expected that he would be a true progressive, and they're worried about his alignment with Wall Street. Teachers are worried, and evidently the administration was not welcome to send somebody to the teachers' union conference because of what they've done with education. His closeness with business, et cetera, has made a lot of people who voted for him concerned about him.
Well,
so
ironically, I think the very fact that he doesn't know much about business has made him put too much faith in business, if that makes any sense. Yes, we're erecting all these new regulatory structures in healthcare and Wall Street. I have my doubts as to how long it's... I don't think it's going to take very long for the industries in question, the healthcare industry and the financial industry, to co-opt the regulators. So I think the progressives have a point. I'm just saying I think deep down he believes in the power of the federal government to do good for people.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also, above all, an ambitious pragmatic politician. I mean, Obama is surrounded by idealism, and he evokes idealism. But I think in terms of wanting to get power and keep power, he's as cold-eyed as any.
Howard Fineman is our guest this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. One line is open. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email, this one from Phil Howard. With regards to the G20, did Obama pledge the nation to austerity or not? Does it give weight to the Cat Food Commission?
I wouldn't take most of those pledges in the G20 very seriously, frankly. I covered the last G20 meeting, which for the main reason was that it was in Pittsburgh, so I got to go home. And it was quite a pageant of security, if nothing else. I mean, they basically blocked off the whole city for that. And I guess they did the same with this most recent one. I think all the leaders of the major economies in the world understand that they have to keep the thing going, which means a lot of deficit spending in a lot of places, but they have to do it in a way that doesn't bankrupt them as states in the future. I mean, we are relying on China, the growth rates in China, India, Russia, Brazil, now Turkey, a few other places, to keep the world going. That's the situation that we're in right now. And we just have to hope that there is enough demand in those places for the productive capacity of the world. We're facing a situation here, at least according to the economic people I talk to in and around the White House, where there's more concern about deflation than inflation right now. In other words, there's more concern about too much capacity and not enough demand. And that's what the leaders of the G20 can say all they want about austerity. But they know if they're too austere, the merry-go-round will stop.
Mm-hmm. Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi.
Mr. Fineman, I wanted to say, in addition to all the great things that Kathleen mentioned in your intro, I'm also a huge fan of your work as chief political correspondent of the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Yeah, that's probably the one I should mention most. I don't know if all your listeners know about that, but Tony is the guy on ESPN, and he's very popular here in D.C., and he's got a podcast. I think it's podcasted and, audio streamed around the world. It's amazing the people you run into.
Yeah, I'm a podcast listener. My question was regarding the Bipartisan Commission on the Federal Debt. I just wondered when we might be hearing from them, what you might guess as to some of their recommendations might be, and how likely they might be to be passed by Congress. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Okay, well, I think the listener raises a really good question. We've been talking about it all morning in terms of austerity versus stimulus and so forth. What are we going to do to get control long-term of health care costs? Barack Obama will tell you that his health care bill will do that down the road. A lot of people have doubts about that. But even if it shaves the growth of the deficit some, it won't do the trick. Then you got Social Security, you've got the retirement of the huge baby boom, which is, going to start dying off, but still around 75 million people, of which I am one. How is the society going to support us in our old age? That's the big question. And I think ultimately that's going to mean some kind of grand compromise on Social Security benefits and health care benefits, and because that's where the money is. And that's going to take something like what happened in the early 80s when the Greenspan Commission decided to slowly raise the Social Security retirement age and so forth. There's going to have to be something like that down the road. Congress is going to want to turn it over to some kind of commission because Congress is not going to have the guts to do it itself, which is a sad commentary on our system, but that's the way it's going to be.
A couple quick questions for you. I couldn't believe this, but maybe it's a sign that this is what will attract people. Did you see that story about a casino being built a half mile from the southern edge of Gettysburg?
Well, they just put a casino in at the old, stately old Greenbrier Resort down in West Virginia. Which,
did they really?
Used to be the height of elegance and now has a casino in it. you know, it's a little bit like the dismal future for the town predicted in the movie Back to the Future.
Right.
Where the evil future, where things all go wrong, the whole town is taken over by gambling casinos. Yes, gambling and wagering has a history in America, and, you know, Harvard College was founded with a lottery and so forth. But I think it's mainly corrosive to our society. It's one of the many things that make you worry about the strength of American society. We can't gamble our way into the future. And I think it's depressing. I think it's a source of revenue for states that ultimately drains productive capacity and doesn't add to it. And I think it's like colorful fungus on a tree stump. It's disturbing.
Yeah, it certainly has helped a lot of tribes in this country, though, hasn't it? Which is kind of ironic.
Yeah, well, some of them have managed it very well. I mean, if you go out to the Phoenix area, the tribes there have done a great job, very responsible environmentally and fiscally and so
right.
forth. But there are a lot of other places where it's created havoc.
Yeah. So what do you think about Larry King's job? Would you like to do that?
No.
No.
I think I like what I do in that I mix media.
Yes.
I write a print column mm-hmm. for the magazine. I write on the web for Newsweek.com and MSNBC.com. I'm an adjunct professor of television and would not want to go on television full-time because TV is TV. I mean, ultimately, it's better to not be committed to any one medium. And frankly, that's the way journalism is going. That's the way. I was sort of a pioneer in this kind of thing. But now every reporter and every writer grows up in a new world being not only their own reporter and editor, but their own marketer and media manager. That's the way it is now.
Yeah. I want to talk about guns for a moment. Supreme mm-hmm. Court ending Chicago's ban on handguns, which had been around for 28 years. Even though Chicago confiscated almost 9,000 guns last year, handguns. Where is the Supreme Court going with this? I mean, can we take it to an extreme and say eventually it's going to be okay for all of us to carry a gun and hang it around our waist as we go to work?
I don't know if it'll get that far, but the key thing was the Supreme Court deciding in this case and in the previous one in the District of Columbia that there is a personal individual right to bear arms, and it's not just something within the context of a regulated militia and, you know, the other language in that amendment. And once you accept that, and that's now two cases that have said that there is an individual right in the Constitution to bear arms, then it becomes a matter of regulating it. And I think the Supreme Court will be open to reasonable regulation, and as the Democrats and Obama get more nominations for the court, I think it'll be a constant argument over regulating that right. But it'll be difficult because once it's embedded in the Constitution, then the doctrine of constitutional law says you have to very, very carefully look at any efforts to regulate that right. So the finger's on the scale in favor of guns.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question. You know, whether we'll end up all looking like we're on a, you know, 1950s Saturday morning TV show, I don't know, but that's possible.
Yeah. Barbara in Superior. Hi, Barbara. We have about a minute left, Barbara.
Oh, good morning. I'm glad I can hear you. Usually I work. But, you know, with the job situation in the United States, I don't know how one president, our President Obama, could create jobs if the whole world economy is struggling, you know, with the wars going on.
Let me just answer very briefly, because I know we don't have much time. The fact is that there is no isolated American economy anymore. There are no borders. It's a global economy in a global world, which makes it difficult for any one man, even an American president, to solve problems. But that's the world we lived in, and that's the world we elected Obama to deal with.
Yeah. So were you doing television tonight, Howard?
Probably.
Probably.
Well, it's never totally clear. It depends on what stories are breaking, what's going on.
Really?
If I do something tonight, it'll be Keith Olbermann at 8 o'clock Eastern.
So you wouldn't find out until just later this morning?
Till later in the day, but I'm busy reporting on stuff regardless. You know, I've always got another column to write or something else to do, so they catch up with me if they want.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I admire your work, and it was just very, very kind of you to give us an hour.
Well, glad to do it. You can tell me in the future whether Russ Feingold is going to survive or not.
Okay, we'll pass you along a message. Okay, thank
Take
you.
Care.
Howard Fineman, our guest. It's a close race. I was looking at that poll yesterday. It's, what, about a percentage point? But it's still early, they say. I don't know. We should do something on that race. It's interesting. Thanks to Howard Fineman for being with us, senior Washington correspondent for Newsweek, author of The 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. And he was here to talk about, well, a variety of issues. We covered a lot this hour, didn't we? Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. And thanks for all of your calls for Howard Fineman. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we'll return with more Tuesday morning conversation and do some traveling in out-of-the-way beautiful spots, not well-trafficked, which is nice when you're vacationing in Wisconsin in the Midwest, and perhaps beyond. Martin Hintz joining us in a few moments.